Stop the podcast.
Stop the podcast.
Hi, everybody. Just to let you know, this episode of Fish is sponsored by TV licensing.
Yes, TV licensing. What are you watching on TV, Andy?
I have been watching a show that's called 2 Weeks in August.
Okay.
Despite it being July at the time of recording.
Oh, you don't have to watch TV shows in the time that their name references.
No, absolutely. I watched The Darling Buds of May in winter. Anyway, 2 Weeks in August. It's a really good series. It's set on a lovely Mediterranean holiday.
Ooh.
And it's a group of old mates from uni who've gathered together. Some of them have got kids. Some of them haven't. Some of them have been going through big life events. And it's one of those amazing pressure cooker series where things just get more and more and more tense.
Oh, those stressful ones.
I love it. I love it.
I love my comedy, I gotta say. So I've been watching Android, which is Diane Morgan's new thing, and I absolutely love it. But I just, for me, I always, on television, watch everything with someone from Bolton in it. That's basically all I watch.
And she's from Bolton?
She's from Bolton.
But in this show, I believe she's a robot.
She's a robot, and it is not certain where in the country she's from.
It depends where the facility is that makes her, I suppose.
I guess so. But what are we actually here to say?
Oh, we're here to say that if you want to watch any of these shows, your TV license covers you to watch over 400 TV channels and everything on BBC iPlayer.
That is incredible.
So 2 Weeks in August has finished going out now, but you can get hold of it on the iPlayer.
If you want to find out more about this, then go to tvl.co.uk/pod.
Now back to the tension and the stress and the misery of this episode of Fish.
Oh, I thought you were referencing Bolton. On with the podcast.
Thanks for staying with us. You're watching an extended edition of Asia First. It's Friday morning, and it's Joe Biden's big day, Julie.
That's right, Adam. The Democratic Party's presidential nominee is set to deliver the most important speech of his lengthy political career this hour, the fourth and final night of the Democratic National Convention. Our U.S. Bureau Chief Simon Marks is joining us again this hour from Washington, D.C. with the details. Simon, you know, Biden's speech today comes without the usual trappings, right? A pandemic has denied him the chance to speak to a cheering crowd, and he'll instead be speaking into a camera. I mean, such a virtual convention was unimaginable even just 6 months ago. So the question is, does a speech without any attendees, in your opinion, change the nature of the message being delivered?
Well, I think there's absolutely no question that the whole nature of this convention, Julie, has been fundamentally different than any of the conventions that we have traditionally covered here over the last 20 plus years on Channel News Asia. The absence not just of a live audience, but also the absence of any tension, any drama. This whole thing over the last four nights has basically been every night a two-hour party political broadcast. With those of us covering it and reporting it, obviously, having no ability to grab a delegate and bring them to the camera and ask them what they thought of the speech that they'd just heard. I mean, even Senator Bernie Sanders, the progressive warhorse who, along with his supporters over the last couple of election cycles, could always be counted on to add some tension to the convention's daily activities. Even he has fallen completely into line. So the absence of a live audience for Joe Biden to play to and with, the inability of speechwriters to include applause lines in speeches because there is no applause. And also, as we saw with Kamala Harris's speech 24 hours ago, the venue where Joe Biden will be speaking, that stadium, that arena in Delaware, where he will basically be talking directly to a camera. And in some of the cutaway shots, you'll see a half dozen socially distanced journalists there and photographers there to observe the event, makes it fundamentally different. Now, the Democrats firmly believe they have connected with the public. And look, this thing has been technically flawless over the last four nights. And I'm sure they're hoping it will be flawless for the remaining, 40 odd minutes that this convention is due to run. But whether it succeeds in reaching out to independent voters and swing voters and engaging them in the same way that it's engaging committed Democrats is a big question.
Well, time will only tell. Simon, stay right where you are, because we've got Michael Bloomberg speaking right now. We just want to listen in on that and come back to you.
It didn't have to be this way. Before I ran for mayor, I spent 20 years running a business I started from scratch. So I want to ask small business owners and their employees one question, and it's a question for everyone. Would you rehire or work for someone who ran your business into the ground and who always does what's best for him or her, even when it hurts the company, and whose reckless decisions put you in danger, and who spends more time tweeting than working? If the answer is no, why the hell would we ever rehire Donald Trump for another 4 years? Trump says we should vote for him because he's a great businessman. Really? He drove his companies into bankruptcy 6 times, always leaving behind customers and contractors who were cheated and swindled and stopped doing business with him. Well, this time, all of us are paying the price, and we can't let him get away with it again. Donald says we should vote for him because the economy was great before the virus. Huh? Biden and Obama created more jobs over their last 3 years than the Trump administration did over their first 3. And economic growth was higher under Biden and Obama than under Trump. In fact, while Biden helped save 1 million auto industry jobs, Trump has lost 250,000 manufacturing jobs. So when Trump says he wants to make America great again, he's making a pretty good case for Joe Biden. Look, our goal shouldn't be to bring back the pandemic economy. It should be, as Joe says, to build it back better. Joe's economic plan will create clean energy jobs that help fight another crisis that Trump is ignoring, climate change. And Joe will rebuild our crumbling roads and bridges, something Trump has incessantly talked about doing.
You're looking at live pictures there, and Mike Bloomberg making the case for Biden. Of course, Bloomberg was one-time opponent who ran against Joe Biden. In fact, Simon, let me bring you in back to the conversation and ask you. The speakers at tonight's convention included many of Biden's former primary rivals. We heard from Andrew Yang, Pete Buttigieg, and Cory Booker. What does this tell you? I mean, it just shows how uncertain this path to a nomination was, doesn't it?
Well, it does. I think that's true, Julie. It does underscore that Joe Biden faced a pretty tough tussle to win this presidential nomination. But they have tried to turn that to their advantage. Just before Michael Bloomberg came on there, there was quite an effective sort of Zoom conversation between Bernie Sanders, Cory Booker, Elizabeth Warren and some of the other former presidential aspirants talking to one another about why they liked Joe Biden, why they admired him and why they had decided to coalesce around him. Michael Bloomberg's own presidential aspirations lasted, I mean, blink and you missed them. I mean, he was in and out of the race in no time whatsoever. And for that reason, I think, by the way, he's a curious choice to have at this prominent point just a few moments before Joe Biden makes his speech, because it's not clear that he speaks to very many Democrats, and it's equally not clear that Republicans and swing voters find him a particularly compelling political character. So interesting that they chose him. They've been at pains all week to show that Joe Biden is supported not just by core Democrats, but by former Republicans, as Michael Bloomberg indeed is. And earlier in the week, of course, we heard from former Governor John Kasich of Ohio, from former Secretary of State Colin Powell. Now, all of those people are by no manner of means core Democrats, and indeed, for various different reasons, have often been largely despised by core Democrats. But the Biden campaign was very eager to show swing voters that the Democratic Party can be a broad church.
Simon, you know, just hours ago, you know, we heard President Trump slamming Biden in his birthplace, Scranton, Pennsylvania. And Trump's predicting an economic disaster, so to speak, if Biden were to be reelected. But here we are, a day after a dismal jobs report, and we're counting down to the final reading of the U.S. Second quarter GDP report. But to be fair, you know, that wasn't brought on by the Trump administration in terms of the economic devastation. And you wouldn't know it with the stock market rally. But regardless of, you know, who becomes the next president, what is the state of the economy that he's going to be inheriting? I mean, it looks pretty bad, but in one sense, but then in another sense, you know, with jobless claims sort of improving from a few months ago, it looks a little bit better.
Yeah, although week by week, you never quite know what you're going to get, Adam. And you're right. I mean, last week's unemployment claims went above a million again after the previous week. They fell below a million for the first time, I think, in 19 weeks, was it? Look, the state of the American economy is parlous. There are now at least 30 million Americans out of work. It is highly likely that Joe Biden in his speech is going to emphasize his view that you can't possibly fix the economy unless and until you fix COVID-19. And that's why Joe Biden is highly likely to emphasize the fact that he's got a national plan for fixing COVID-19. We still don't know the full details of it, but we know, for example, that over the last couple of weeks, he's urged Americans to spend the next 3 months wearing face masks. And he's faulted President Trump for failing to have any kind of national approach to fixing the COVID-19 crisis. So there's going to be enormous challenges, whether it's Donald Trump, who continues in the presidency. He insists, of course, that he created the greatest economy in American history before. That's hyperbole, but there's no question that the health of the economy was strong on his watch before COVID-19. Now he says, I'm just having to build it back again. Joe Biden's three-word mantra at the moment is build back better. Don't just build it back the way it was, but build it back in a way that prepares the country for the new technologies of the future, that embraces the need to deal with climate change, and also underscores the fact that COVID-19 has changed everything in American society. And as Dr. Anthony Fauci was saying over the last few months, you can't just flick the American economy back on like it's a light switch. We're going to go through months with a hard winter coming up, respiratory diseases, more COVID-19 in the United States over the winter months. There are going to be all sorts of openings and closings, and sometimes things will look like they're all reopened, and then other times the schools will be shut down again, the universities will be sending students home, offices and businesses will be shuttered. So it is going to be a roller coaster to navigate for whichever of these two men, Joe Biden or Donald Trump, ends up in the Oval Office.
And Simon, what did the polls tell us less than 3 months before the November 3rd election?
Depends entirely, Julie, which poll you're reading. On Monday of this week, you could read the ABC Washington Post opinion poll that tells you that Joe Biden is 11 points ahead of Donald Trump and convincingly beating him in all the battleground swing states where the election will ultimately be won or lost. The previous day, Sunday, you could have read the CNN Wall Street Journal poll that said that Donald Trump had narrowed the gap with Joe Biden to just 4 percentage points. I think, first of all, everyone is taking all of these polls with an enormous grain of salt. We learned, didn't we, back in 2016, not just that polls could be unreliable, but also those projections of the probability of, at the time, Hillary Clinton winning the presidency. I remember on election night, the New York Times probability index, when we started our broadcast, she was 89% probable to win the presidency. And then over the course of the evening, it all just totally eked away. So first of all, people are very cautious about opinion polls, although I see Donald Trump has once again tonight been citing on Twitter that he has a 96% approval rating within the Republican Party. By the way, he's been appearing on Fox News over the last few minutes, again, berating Joe Biden, berating the Democrats, and raising questions about Joe Biden's cognitive abilities in that interview. But I think there's also an awareness that because of the nature of the way in which this election is run. It's not a direct election. Everything goes through the Electoral College. There are all sorts of potential bumps in the road. As Hillary Clinton reminded Democrats last night, she knows better than anyone. You can win the popular vote in this country by nearly 3 million votes, and you can still lose the presidency. That's why all of these polls are very tough to interpret, and you shouldn't base your viewpoint, I think, on any of them.
No, if anything, 2016 proved to be completely unreliable. I do remember because I was reporting from New York when you were in Washington. It was absolutely staggering to see, the stark change throughout the day, throughout the evening. Yeah, I mean, we saw U.S. futures tumble, 700 points on the prospect that Donald Trump was going to be the president of the United States. And the very next day, I think, rebounded 1,000. I mean, it was remarkable, special time. So, yeah, given that uncertainty then, Simon, if you think about it, it's got to be a lot more uncertain now because, you know, we're also talking about in this pandemic crisis, the prospect of mail-in ballots, which has been so politically charged in the US at this point in time, at least back in 2016 and previous elections, we know very rapidly, you know, who's likely going to be making it to the White House. If we have these mail-in ballots, this could be a dragged out process.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it is highly unlikely that when we bring you our election night here, morning there broadcast on Wednesday, November the 4th, Singapore time, I think it's highly unlikely we are going to be able to tell you who has won this American presidential election, unless it is the absolute landslide that Democrats this week have been calling for. They know that President Donald Trump is going to fight tooth and nail, particularly over this issue of mail-in ballots, postal ballots. We've just been through several days of uproar over the president's postmaster general, a political appointee, taking sorting machines out of service, carting away post boxes in several key states. We're going to see, in the event that this is a closely fought battle, President Trump going to the legal mat. He's going to want to see the signatures on every single postal vote, and he's going to want to match them up to the signatures of the alleged voters. He's been talking again on Fox here just within the last few minutes, predicting that the election is going to be fraudulent and that the only way the Democrats can win it, he said this earlier in the day in Scranton as well, is if Joe Biden and the Democrats rig it. Equally, the Democrats are surrounding themselves with lawyers because they know that this could absolutely end up not just being litigated between the two parties, but potentially end up in the courts. Remember that the Al Gore, George W. Bush election ended up at the Supreme Court. And it was the Supreme Court that essentially determined that George W. Bush was going to win the keys to the Oval Office. So both parties are absolutely legally prepared for that. And I actually think it was interesting that Kamala Harris has prosecutorial experience. You know, she was a prosecutor, highly trained lawyer. I don't think that's why she was brought onto the ticket at all, but it certainly could be very useful experience.
Certainly. And Simon, let's just remind our viewers that we are waiting for Joe Biden to accept his party's presidential nomination. Simon, this is not Biden's first bid for the White House, right? He has sought the Democratic presidential nomination for nearly half his life. Can you remind our viewers what happened during those earlier attempts and how is it going to be different this time around?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, the Democrats know that while this is one of Joe Biden's strong suits, that he's got all of this experience, it's also a weakness because it gives Donald Trump and his campaign, you know, 50, 60 years in politics to attack. Joe Biden, if he becomes president, will be 78 when he's sworn in, the oldest president ever to assume office in the United States. His first presidential campaign was back in 1988. And at the time, he was undone by an act of plagiarism. He made a speech, and this was all pre-internet and pre-YouTube, but he made a speech that was almost a direct lift from a speech that the British Labour Party leader at the time, Neil Kinnock, had made. And the problem is not just that it was plagiarised, but that it was a deeply personal speech. Neil Kinnock had asked a Labour Party conference, why am I the first in the generation of Kinnocks to have gone to university? Why is my wife the first in the generation of her family? And so on and so forth. And Joe Biden made exactly the same speech about his own experience and the experience of his family. So that absolutely undid him. For a while, of course, he sought the presidency again when Barack Obama was seeking the Democratic Party's nomination. He ended up not winning that primary contest. Barack Obama then took him on as vice president. And I suppose the most interesting aspect of Joe Biden's biography, and it's something we're going to hear about more about very, very shortly, is the presidential race he didn't run, which is the presidential race back in 2016. The widely held assumption was that he would seek the presidency in 2016, but in 2015, his son, Bo Biden, who was the attorney general in the state of Delaware, where Joe Biden lives, died of brain cancer. And Joe Biden was, of course, deeply, deeply affected by that and decided, after giving it considerable amounts of thought, that he would not seek the presidency in 2016, even though Bo Biden on his deathbed had told his father to run. So Joe Biden didn't run that year. That's how the Democratic Party ended up with Hillary Clinton as its candidate. And some would argue here, that's how the country ended up with Donald Trump as president. And so for Joe Biden, there's an opportunity here to change the historical story so far by getting into the race now, even though, as I say, he will be the oldest president ever to be sworn into office if he succeeds in winning the presidency. I think we're about to see this tribute to Bo Biden, Joe Biden's late son, which is serving as one of the final events at this convention leading up to Joe Biden's speech.
And speaking of opportunities for Joe Biden, Simon, let's talk about Steve Bannon now. His arrest today comes on the final night of the DNC, also coming at a very critical time for President Trump. Could his prosecution, the latest in the string against the former Trump officials, do the president's campaign, you know, for a re-election any harm? Could this be good news for Joe Biden?
Well, it's manna from heaven for Joe Biden. For news of that arrest to break just hours before this all-important speech at the end of a Democratic convention in which the Democrats have insisted that decency lies at the core of their campaign, empathy for the working man, and then to see Steve Bannon underscoring through this indictment that within Donald Trump's inner circle, there has been in the past grubbiness and corruption is an extraordinary gift for the Democrats, especially given the nature of the charges Steve Bannon faces, namely defrauding ordinary working Americans out of hundreds of thousands of dollars as he sought to raise money for construction of a section of that border wall that Donald Trump wants to build along the U.S. border with Mexico. So it's a political gift for Joe Biden. It's going to be very interesting to see whether Joe Biden makes a reference to it during the course of his speech tonight. Mm. Steve Bannon was arrested this morning on a yacht floating in the waters off Connecticut, owned by Chinese fugitive tycoon Guo Wangwei. And that in and of itself has raised questions about whether there is a broader investigation of Steve Bannon's association with that Chinese tycoon that officials here are beginning to dig into.
Well, when it comes to politics, Simon, we know very well that, you know, political hopefuls will always, you know, pounce on an opportunity when there's some dirt out there. But listen, I want to get to this because the other thing that's rather unusual and unique this time is not just the fact that this election is being conducted in a dreadful pandemic and the U.S. the worst affected, but I'm not sure if you know this and the history. You've covered politics in the U.S. for a long time. How many times have there been successful VPs that have made it to a presidency in the recent history? Because you'd have to go a long way back, wouldn't you, to sort of pick some parallels of when that does happen. Because usually when you get a presidential hopeful, they pick a VP that is not really going to steal the limelight or be as charismatic, let's say, as a presidential hopeful. So this could be a rather unique situation, could it not?
Well, I think you'd have to go back to George H.W. Bush, wouldn't you? Ronald Reagan's vice president, who went on to win an election, serve one term in office. He was ousted after one term in office after having told essentially a bit of a lie at the Republican convention that year. Read my lips, no new taxes. The voters decided that, in fact, he had raised taxes. And that's one of the reasons why the pledge that he had made when he accepted the party's presidential nominee and went on to win the presidency, ultimately 4 years later, resulted in his removal from office. Look, these vice presidential picks are important. There's no question about it. But there is not much evidence to suggest that many voters vote for the ticket because of the vice presidential nominee. I think what is so interesting about this particular year is Kamala Harris at 55, her relative youth, compared to Joe Biden's age, 77 currently. Joe Biden said he wanted a vice presidential pick who would be absolutely ready to pick up the reins were anything to happen to him. He's very aware of where he is in terms of the arc of his political career. And so his hope is that in Kamala Harris, he's found someone who is poised and ready to take over from him should he decide not to seek another term in office in 2024, but who also could pick up the reins whatever unexpected developments might beset the White House after the inauguration of January 2021. So it's a very, very interesting choice. But you're right, very few of these vice presidential candidates go on to future success. We didn't see it with Al Gore. We didn't see it, of course, with Dick Cheney. I think there'll be questions about whether Mike Pence has got a political future in a post-Trump world, whenever we find ourselves in a post-Trump world. But that's one of the reasons why I think there's a lot of interest about Kamala Harris.
And Simon, I mean, you know, there's always a raft of major issues that matter to American voters during the election campaign period when they're looking at the perspectives that are going to move into the White House, you know, for whatever number of terms. But, you know, what are this time around the most important issues to the American voters? Usually it is about jobs, you know, the economy, and also nobody wants their taxes to go up and healthcare. They're just a gamut of hot button issues that cut across this political divide when it comes to electioneering and campaigning during a presidential election. But this year is quite different because I suppose, as a result of the devastation of COVID-19, it amplifies the importance of the economy and jobs. And of course, you know, the issue of COVID-19 itself and also geopolitics behind that.
Yeah, and I think in many ways you can't break those issues apart. I mean, COVID-19 is such a dominant issue here, and it affects every American in every facet of their lives. Huge issues here. Are the kids going to go back to schools? Are businesses going to be able to reopen, particularly in the service sector? What are the impacts going to be on the healthcare system if there's another major wave of COVID-19 infections once we get into the winter months here? What is the ultimate impact going to be on the US relationship with China, particularly with Donald Trump relentlessly describing this as the China plague, having pulled the United States out of the World Health Organization, chiding the World Health Organization for the American government says being far too credulous about the information that it was first receiving from China. What are the impacts of all of this going to be more broadly on American society? Can a new government come into power, whether it's in 2021 or thereafter, and effectively forge a national strategy to defeat COVID-19 in a country where there are so many Americans who believe in New Hampshire's state motto, live free or die? We've seen what an extraordinary struggle it is to get people in many parts of the country to wear face masks in public, to stop engaging in activities that don't involve social distance and large crowds. What happens to very vibrant sectors of the economy like live sports? A massive issue for many American voters. There are millions of American voters out there who desperately want to see American football being played again, and it's very unclear how soon and under what circumstances that is going to be able to happen. So, look, I mean, I just think this is a country at the moment asking itself a whole variety of absolutely fundamental questions about what kind of society this is going to be moving forward. And so many people, not here in Washington, D.C., or up in New York, or out in San Francisco, so many people in the middle of the country don't like being told what to do by government, are skeptical about whether COVID-19 really is the threat that public health officials say it is, and are not necessarily going to hew to a message from a Democratic Party candidate that it's time for everybody to get serious and try and beat this thing down, even if that means over the short term, another economic shutdown. I think the country is aware that it's in for a very rough ride, but it's not entirely sure how on earth it's going to make its way through that journey.
Simon, indeed. And, you know, on the other side of the political aisle, Republicans will be holding their own national convention from 24th till 27th in Charlotte, North Carolina. Much like the DNC, the event is likely to be held virtually, mostly. What can we expect from there? Will it be able to generate the same kind of enthusiasm and energy that we have seen for the Democratic Party?
Well, let me tell you who's got the worst job in America tonight, Julie. It's the man or the woman who's running the Republican National Convention. And I'll tell you why they've got the worst job in the world. We now know, partly from the interview that he's just given to Fox News, but also to what we've been hearing from the White House during the course of the day, that President Trump has been watching the Democratic Convention and he wants to make a whole host of changes.
Sorry, we have to interrupt you there. We've got to get to Joe Biden.
Give people light. Those are words for our time. The current president has cloaked American darkness for much too long. Too much anger, too much fear, too much division. Here and now, I give you my word. If you entrust me with the presidency, I will draw on the best of us, not the worst. I'll be an ally of the light, not the darkness. It's time for us, for we the people, to come together. And make no mistake, united we can and will overcome this season of darkness in America. We'll choose hope over fear, facts over fiction, fairness over privilege. I'm a proud Democrat, and I'll be proud to carry the banner of our party into the general election. So it's with great honor and humility I accept this nomination for president of the United States of America. But while I'll be a Democratic candidate, I will be an American president. I'll work hard for those who didn't support me, as hard for them as I did for those who did vote for me. That's the job of a president, to represent all of us, not just our base or our party. This is not a partisan moment. This must be an American moment. It's a moment that calls for hope and light and love, hope for our future, light to see our way forward, and love for one another. America isn't just a collection of clashing interests of red states or blue states. We're so much bigger than that. We're so much better than that. You know, nearly a century ago, Franklin Roosevelt pledged a New Deal in a time of massive unemployment, uncertainty, and fear. Stricken by a disease, stricken by a virus, FDR insisted that he would recover and prevail, and he believed America could as well. And he did, and we can as well. This campaign isn't just about winning votes. It's about winning the heart and, yes, the soul of America. Winning it for the generous among us, not the selfish. Winning it for workers who keep this country going, not just the privileged few at the top. Winning for those communities who have known the injustice of a knee on the neck. For all the young people who have known only America being of rising inequity and shrinking opportunity, they deserve the experience of America's promise. They deserve to experience it in full. You know, no generation ever knows what history will ask of it. All we can ever know is whether we're ready when that moment arrives. And now history has delivered us to one of the most difficult moments America's ever faced. Four historic crises, all at the same time. A perfect storm, the worst pandemic in over 100 years, the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression, the most compelling call for racial justice since the 60s, and the undeniable realities and just the accelerating threats of climate change. So the question for us is simple. Are we ready? I believe we are. We must be. You know, all elections are important,
We know in our bones this one is more consequential. As many have said, America is at an inflection point, a time of real peril, but also of extraordinary possibilities. We can choose a path of becoming angrier, less hopeful, more divided, a path of shadow and suspicion, or we can choose a different path and together take this chance to heal, to reform, to unite, a path of hope and light. This is a life-changing election. This will determine what America is going to look like for a long, long time. Character is on the ballot. Compassion is on the ballot. Decency, science, democracy, they're all on the ballot. Who we are as a nation, what we stand for, and most importantly, who we want to be, that's all on the ballot. And the choice could not be more clear. No rhetoric is needed. Just judge this president on the facts. 5 million Americans infected by COVID-19. More than 170,000 Americans have died. By far the worst performance of any nation on earth. More than 50 million people have filed for unemployment this year. More than 10 million people are going to lose their health insurance this year. Nearly 1 in 6 small businesses have closed this year. And this president, if he's reelected, you know what will happen. Cases and deaths will remain far too high. More mom-and-pop businesses will close their doors, and this time for good. Working families will struggle to get by. And yet the wealthiest 1% will get tens of billions of dollars in new tax breaks. And the assault on the Affordable Care Act will continue until it's destroyed, taking insurance away from more than 20 million people, including more than 15 million people on Medicaid, and getting rid of the protections that President Obama worked so hard to get passed for people who have 100 million more people who have pre-existing conditions. And speaking of President Obama, a man I was honored to serve alongside for 8 years as vice president, let me take this moment to say something we don't say nearly enough. Thank you, Mr. President. You were a great president, a president our children could and did look up to. No one's going to say that about the current occupant of the White House. What we know about this president is if he's given 4 more years, he'll be what he's been for the last 4 years. President who takes no responsibility, refuses to lead, blames others, cozies up to dictators, and fans the flames of hate and division. He'll wake up every day believing the job is all about him, never about you. Is that the American you want for you, your family, your children? I see a different America, one that's generous and strong, selfless and humble. It's an America we can rebuild together. As president, the first step I will take will be to get control of the virus that has ruined so many lives. Because I understand something this president hasn't from the beginning. We will never get our economy back on track. We will never get our kids safely back in schools. We'll never have our lives back until we deal with this virus. The tragedy of where we are today is it didn't have to be this bad. Just look around. It's not this bad in Canada or Europe or Japan or almost anywhere else in the world. And the president keeps telling us the virus is going to disappear. He keeps waiting for a miracle. Well, I have news for him. No miracle is coming. We lead the world in confirmed cases. We lead the world in deaths. Our economy is in tatters with Black, Latino, Asian American, Native American communities bearing the brunt of it. And after all this time, the president still does not have a plan. Well, I do. If I'm your president, on day one, we'll implement the national strategy I've been laying out since March. We'll develop and deploy rapid tests with results available immediately. We'll make the medical supplies and protective equipment that our country needs, and we'll make them here in America so we will never again be at the mercy of China or other foreign countries in order to protect our own people. We'll make sure our schools have the resources they need to be open, safe, and effective. We'll put politics aside. We'll take the muzzle off our experts so the public gets the information they need and deserve. Honest, unvarnished truth. They can handle it. We'll have a national mandate to wear masks, not as a burden, but as a patriotic duty to protect one another. In short, we'll do what we should have done from the very beginning. Our current president has failed in his most basic duty to the nation. He's failed to protect us. He's failed to protect America. And my fellow Americans, that is unforgivable. As president, I'll make you a promise. I'll protect America. I will defend us from every attack, seen and unseen, always, without exception, every time. Look, I understand. I understand how hard it is to have any hope right now. On this summer night, let me take a moment to speak to those of you who have lost the most. I have some idea how it feels to lose someone you love. I know that deep black hole that opens up in the middle of your chest and you feel like you're being sucked into it. I know how mean and cruel and unfair life can be sometimes. But I've learned two things. First, your loved one may have left this earth, but they'll never leave your heart. They'll always be with you. You'll always hear them. And second, I found the best way through pain and loss and grief is to find purpose. As God's children, each of us have a purpose in our lives. We have a great purpose as a nation to open the doors of opportunity to all Americans, to save our democracy, to be a light to the world once again, and finally to live up to and make real the words written in the sacred documents that founded this nation, that all men and women are created equal, endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, among them life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. You know, my dad was an honorable, decent man. He got knocked down a few times pretty hard, but he always got back up. He worked hard, and he built a great middle-class life for our family. He used to say, "Joey, I don't expect the government to solve my problems, but I sure in hell expect them to understand them." And then he'd say, "Joey, a job is about a lot more than a paycheck. It's about your dignity. It's about respect. It's about your place in the community. It's about being able to look your kid in the eye and say, honey, it's going to be okay, and mean it." I've never forgotten those lessons. That's why my economic plan is all about jobs, dignity, respect, and community. Together we can and will rebuild our economy. And when we do, we'll not only build back, we'll build back better. With modern roads, bridges, highways, broadband, ports and airports as a new foundation for economic growth, with pipes that transport clean water to every community, with 5 million new manufacturing and technology jobs so the future is made in America, with a healthcare system that lowers premiums, deductibles, drug prices, by building on the Affordable Care Act he's trying to rip away, with an education system that trains our people for the best jobs of the 21st century. There's not a single thing American workers can't do. And where cost doesn't prevent young people from going to college and student debt doesn't crush them when they get out. With a child care and elder care system that makes it possible for parents to go to work and for the elderly to stay in their homes with dignity. With an immigration system that powers our economy and reflects our values, and with newly empowered labor unions. They're the ones that built the middle class. With equal pay for women, with rising wages, you can raise a child on, a family on. And yes, We're going to do more than praise our essential workers. We're finally going to pay them. Pay them. We can and we will deal with climate change. It's not only a crisis, it's an enormous opportunity. An opportunity for America to lead the world in clean energy and create millions of new good-paying jobs in the process. And we can pay for these investments by ending loopholes, unnecessary loopholes, and the president's $1.3 trillion tax giveaway to the wealthiest 1% and the biggest, most profitable corporations, some of which do not pay any tax at all. Because we don't need a tax code that rewards wealth more than it rewards work. I'm not looking to punish anyone. Far from it. But it's long past time the wealthiest people and the biggest corporations in this country paid their fair share. And for our seniors, Social Security is a sacred obligation, a sacred promise made, they paid for. The current president is threatening to break that promise. He's proposing to eliminate a tax that pays for almost half the Social Security without any way of making up for that lost revenue, resulting in cuts. I will not let that happen. If I'm your president, we're going to protect Social Security and Medicare. You have my word. One of the most powerful voices we hear in the country today is from our young people. They're speaking to the inequity and injustice that has grown up in America. Economic injustice, racial injustice, environmental injustice. I hear their voices. If you listen, you can hear them too. And whether it's the existential threat posed by climate change, the daily fear of being gunned down in school, or the inability to get started in your first job, it will be the work of the next president to restore the promise of America to everyone. And I'm not going to have to do it alone, because I'll have a great vice president at my side, Senator Kamala Harris. She's a powerful voice for this nation. Her story is the American story. She knows about all the obstacles thrown in the way of so many in our country. Women, Black Americans, South Asian Americans, immigrants, the left out and the left behind. But she's overcome every obstacle she's ever faced. No one's been tougher on the big banks and the gun lobby. No one's been tougher in calling out the current administration for its extremism, its failure to follow the law, its failure to simply tell the truth. Kamala and I both draw from our families. That's where we get our strength. For Kamala, it's Doug and their families. For me, it's Jill and ours. I've said many times, no man deserves one great love in his life, let alone two. But I've known two. After losing my first wife in that car accident, Jill came into my life. And she put our family back together. She's an educator, a mom, a military mom, and an unstoppable force. If she puts her mind to it, just get out of the way. She's going to get it done. She was a great second lady. And I know she'll make a great first lady for this nation. She loves this country so much. And I'll always have the strength that can only come from family. Hunter, Ashley, all our grandchildren, my brothers, my sister, they give me courage. They lift me up. While he's no longer with us, Bo inspires me every day. Bo served our nation in uniform. A year in Iraq, a decorated Iraqi war veteran. So I take very personally and the profound responsibility of serving as Commander-in-Chief. I'll be a president who will stand with our allies and friends and make it clear to our adversaries, the days of cozying up to dictators is over. Under President Biden, America will not turn a blind eye to Russian bounties on the heads of American soldiers. Nor will I put up with foreign interference in our most sacred democratic exercise, voting.
And I'll always stand for our values of human rights and dignity. I'll work in common purpose for a more secure, peaceful, and prosperous world. History has thrust one more urgent task on us. Will we be the generation that finally wipes out the stain of racism from our national character? I believe we're up to it. I believe we're ready. Just a week ago yesterday was the third anniversary of the events in Charlottesville. Close your eyes. Remember what you saw on television. Remember seeing those neo-Nazis and Klansmen and white supremacists coming out of fields with lighted torches, veins bulging, spewing the same anti-Semitic bile heard across Europe in the 30s. Remember the violent clash that ensued between those spreading hate and those with the courage to stand against it. And remember what the president said when asked? He said there were, quote, very fine people on both sides. It was a wake-up call for us as a country. And for me, a call to action. At that moment, I knew I'd have to run. Because my father taught us that silence was complicity. And I could never remain silent or complicit. At the time, I said we're in the battle for the soul of this nation. And we are. You know, one of the most important conversations I've had this entire campaign, it was with someone who was much too young to vote. I met with 6-year-old Gianna Floyd the day before her daddy, George Floyd, was laid to rest. She's an incredibly brave little girl. And I'll never forget it. When I leaned down to speak to her, she looked in my eyes and she said, and I quote, "Daddy changed the world. Daddy changed the world." Her words burrowed deep into my heart. Maybe George Floyd's murder was a breaking point. Maybe John Lewis is passing the inspiration. But however it's come to be, however it's happened, America's ready, in John's words, to lay down, quote, the heavy burden of hate at last. And to end the hard work of rooting out our systemic racism. You know, American history tells us that it's been in our darkest moments that we've made our greatest progress, that we found the light. In this dark moment, I believe we're poised to make great progress again, that we can find the light once more. You know, many people have heard me say this, but I've always believed you can define America in one word. Possibilities. The defining feature of America, everything is possible. That in America, everyone, and I mean everyone, should be given an opportunity to go as far as their dreams and God-given ability will take them. We can never lose that. In times as challenging as these, I believe there's only one way forward. As a united America, a united America, united in our pursuit of a more perfect union, united in our dreams of a better future for us and for our children, united in our determination to make the coming years bright. Are you ready? I believe we are. This is a great nation. We're a good and decent people. For Lord's sake, this is the United States of America. And there's never been anything we've been able to accomplish when we've done it together. The Irish poet Seamus Heaney once wrote, "History says, don't hope on this side of the grave, but then, once in a lifetime, the longed-for tidal wave of justice can rise up and hope and history rhyme." This is our moment to make hope and history rhyme. With passion and purpose, let us begin, you and I together, one nation, under God, united in our love for America, united in our love for each other.
For love is more powerful than hate. Hope is more powerful than fear. And light is more powerful than dark. This is our moment. This is our mission. May history be able to say that the end of this chapter of American darkness began here tonight as love and hope and light join in the battle for the soul of the nation. And this is a battle we will win, and we'll do it together. I promise you. Thank you, and may God bless you, and may God protect our troops.
That was Joe Biden delivering his acceptance speech of as a presidential nominee for the Democratic Party. It was delivered from Chase Center in Mr. Biden's hometown of Wilmington, Delaware. Now, just a quick reminder, the theme of the program this fourth and final night was America's Promise. And pretty much Joe Biden kept to that theme. The idea was to tell America that you have all it takes to be great. I will deliver on that promise for all. Of course, the speech, lots of pot shots taken at the current president. He accused President Trump's America of being cloaked in darkness for much too long. That was just at the opening. Too much anger, too much fear, too much division. And I give you my word, if you entrust me with the presidency, I will draw out the best of us, not the worst. I'll be an ally for light, not the darkness. It's time for us to come together. Now, hope over fear, facts over fiction. The idea was to unite together. Now, for anyone looking for more concrete policy points from Mr. Biden's speech, there was relatively little of that, although perhaps speeches like these are not really for laying out clear and substantial policy. What he did do was to combine policy points with his comments about more homespun anecdotes and recognition of important values like respect, love, and light. He brought up the fact that there was absolutely no way America was going to be moving ahead with bringing children back to school and jobs if they did not solve the problem of the pandemic. He mentioned President Trump's reference to this looking forward to miracles and told President Trump there will be no miracle coming, and that President Trump has failed in his most basic duty, and that as president, Mr. Biden will protect America and defend Americans from every attack. And we cross to Washington, where our U.S. Bureau Chief Simon Marks has been following tonight's developments closely. Simon, very quickly, if I could ask you this, do you see any clear policy points, substantial points made on anything, whether it's on China, on Russia, on climate change, on economic policies, on taking back Donald Trump's tax cuts, anything in between in this very emotive speech that Mr. Biden made this evening?
Well, it was a very emotive speech, Ray. So it was a very passionate speech, and it was a very empathetic speech, which is what Democrats believe the American public wanted to hear after the country's extraordinary battle with COVID-19. I can tell you that right now in Wilmington, Delaware, fireworks are filling the night sky after this speech by Joe Biden. He and his wife, Kamala Harris, and her husband have gone out to see a small, socially distanced crowd outside the Chase Center that gathered to cheer them on their way after this speech. This was sweeping stuff from Joe Biden, but there were some specific policy indications in there. First of all, he made it apparent that he's going to order a national face mask mandate here in the United States should he be elected president. In foreign policy terms, he said that he's going to engage in sweeping change from what the United States is witnessing at the moment. The days of cozying up to dictators is over. He said a Biden presidency will not turn a blind eye, for example, to the Russian government paying bounties for American and allied soldiers killed in Afghanistan. He said the country will always stand for human rights and dignity. This is not a speech that mentioned any specific country beyond that reference to Russia there. He said that he will always seek to protect American citizens against any enemies or threats, seen or unseen. And he faulted President Trump, saying that President Trump had failed in his single most important mission as president of the United States, to protect Americans. And you could see that Joe Biden was talking there not just about COVID-19, but also talking about things like interference in America's elections from foreign sources. The word, the single word that we heard most often in this speech, and I'm dying to get my hands on a transcript because I want to see exactly how many times it was used, but at least half a dozen, was the word light. Joe Biden kept contrasting the light that he hopes to lead America towards to the very dark place in which the country finds itself now. And at the end of the speech, he invited Americans to join him. Are you ready? He said to them, I believe we are. And he said that he said, can establish that love can triumph hate, hope can triumph fear. And again, light is more powerful than dark. He said that he's going to end this particular chapter of American darkness starting right here tonight. And that, I think, is the overriding message that he's trying to develop. He's trying to deliver to Americans. He's got a plan to lead Americans into the light, and he wants them to join him for the walk.
Well, Simon, it wasn't just light. A lot of mention of peace, of love, of family, of unity. However, and I'm playing devil's advocate here, he also talked about enormous challenges in real terms. So in terms of employment, the economy, fighting a pandemic, these things take a great deal more than feeling good about yourself. People might want to see more substantial, concrete plans for how he intends to do these things. For example, if you talk about human rights, when he was vice president with Barack Obama, surely the two of them would have mentioned very strong human rights with China and made relatively little progress on that front. Now, if you mention that again, what progress are you going to be making on the most important relationship of the woman, which is relations with China? How are you going to be doing this if presidents prior to you have failed to do that?
No, I think it's a very, very fair point, Wei Su, and this was not a speech that was going to answer any of those questions. And it's not even clear to me that we'll get answers to those questions between now and November the 3rd, unless very specific questions are posed to Joe Biden and to Donald Trump during the upcoming presidential debates. We know from the way in which he's spoken now that he's talking about embracing human rights and prioritizing human dignity. But you're absolutely right. The Obama and Biden administration tried that previously and still found themselves making limited amounts of headway in terms of the relationship with China. He's talking about ending the era of racial discrimination and racism in the United States. He cited in this speech four separate simultaneous crises that he says the country is facing. The COVID-19 pandemic, of course, the economic crisis that the country is facing, the country's quest and thirst for racial justice, and of course, he said, a commitment to defeating climate change. Now, critics of Joe Biden and Barack Obama will say, well, all of those issues and others, other than COVID-19, but all of those issues and others that he glanced at in the speech, gun control, for example, those were all on the agenda here back throughout Barack Obama's time in office. Look at gun control. Nothing meaningful was achieved during Barack Obama's 8 years in office. It was also interesting that at one point in the speech, Joe Biden, speaking about the economy, insisted there's not a single thing American workers cannot do. I thought it was very interesting that he cited the example of Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the New Deal of the 1930s. He was talking here, Joe Biden, about the kind of infrastructural projects that Franklin Delano Roosevelt absolutely kicked off in the United States. But FDR was accused by his opponents of being a radical socialist. Exactly the kind of terminology that Donald Trump uses about Joe Biden. There's one other overriding point about this speech worth making. I was looking at the DNC's, the Democratic National Committee's official live stream of the speech. As Joe Biden was speaking, it was being watched by fewer than 40,000 people. He had a big job tonight to connect not just with Democrats, but with Americans in key swing states who may be persuaded to cross the aisle, abandon Donald Trump, and join him on that journey into the light that he's promising. It is still not entirely clear that this Democratic convention over the last four nights has succeeded in reaching many of those voters, changing many minds. It's absolutely energized the Democrats. They love the sweeping rhetoric. They're excited about what may lie ahead. But those specific issues that you're talking about and the need for specific plans definitely weren't in this speech. It's going to be very interesting to see between now and November the 3rd just how Joe Biden advances all of those arguments.
Oh, thanks very much for all that. Simon Marks breaking down the speech for us and giving us much more historical context with this acceptance speech by Joe Biden.
Stop the podcast.
Stop the podcast.
Hi, everybody. Just to let you know, this episode of Fish is sponsored by TV licensing.
Yes, TV licensing. What are you watching on TV, Andy?
I have been watching a show that's called 2 Weeks in August.
Okay.
Despite it being July at the time of recording.
Oh, you don't have to watch TV shows in the time that their name references.
No, absolutely. I watched The Darling Buds of May in winter. Anyway, 2 Weeks in August. It's a really good series. It's set on a lovely Mediterranean holiday.
Ooh.
And it's a group of old mates from uni who've gathered together. Some of them have got kids, some of them haven't. Some of them have been going through big life events. And it's one of those amazing pressure cooker series where things just get more and more and more tense.
Oh, those stressful ones.
I love it. I love it.
I love my comedy, I gotta say. So I've been watching Android, which is Diane Morgan's new thing, and I absolutely love it. But I just, for me, I always, on television, watch everything with someone from Bolton in it. That's basically all I watch.
And she's from Bolton.
She's from Bolton.
But in this show, I believe she's a robot.
She's a robot, and it is not certain where in the country she's from.
It depends where the facility is that makes her, I suppose.
I guess so. But what are we actually here to say?
Oh, we're here to say that if you want to watch any of these shows, your TV license covers you to watch over 400 TV channels and everything on BBC iPlayer.
That is incredible.
So 2 Weeks in August has finished going out now, but you can get hold of it on the iPlayer.
If you want to find out more about this, then go to tvl.co.uk/pod.
Now back to the tension and the stress and the misery of this episode of Fish.
Oh, I thought you were referencing Bolton. On with the podcast.